Maybe it's your parents' love letters, your grandma's diary, or even a note passed to you when you were in fifth grade. Today, we'll talk about handwriting as a link to our past and a way to connect with each other. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbe. There was a time not so long ago when teaching handwriting was as important as teaching students to read. That time is gone.
People don't want to take the time anymore to really learn and do flowing methods of writing. I hope none of my grandkids are listening, but I just think that they don't write very well anymore.
This hour, the evolution of handwriting and what we might be losing in this age of texting and typing. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Handwritten letters, documents, journals, and notes are an important link to our past, historically speaking, and also on a personal level. This hour, we'll talk about the evolution of handwriting and what we might be losing in this age of texting and typing. You might receive a text message that quickens your pulse. You might read a profound blog post or receive an email that makes your heart sing. But many of us still treasure handwritten pieces of the past. IPR producers Lindsay Moon and Claire Roth went out and they asked people about their handwritten treasures.
Yeah, I actually have a cookbook and then quite a few letters that my grandma sent me while I was in college and lots of cards that family has sent me over the years. Everything's so digital and I don't even print photographs anymore, like with my digital camera. So I think just having that paper item is special.
My grandmother gave me this strange little gold box. In it, she had a little card and she wrote in handwriting on the back of this Christmas card that she had cut in half, she always saved stuff. So she always wrote on saved pieces of old cards that this little box is a cricket cage. You catch crickets in the summer and keep them in this little gold box. I love you, Laura. Merry Christmas. And she folded it into a little square and put it in the cricket catcher box. It's almost like her body, or it's so intimately connected to who she is for me, because she always wrote stuff to us, for us, on everything she gave us. It was just part of who she was.
I own part of a farm, and we have the abstract going clear back into the middle 1800s, and the handwriting of the people who sign that over the years is very, very interesting. It's beautiful. It's similar to what we probably would think of as calligraphy today.
I have an old newspaper clipping from Jackie Robinson, his first week in the major leagues. He signed a newspaper article that talked about him being the first Negro player in baseball, and I actually got that from my grandfather, and that's something that's pretty memorable to me because I'm a baseball fan, but it's also a big part of the civil rights movement with him being the first African American in baseball.
We have this family tree book. Some of the things in it are written, and it has my dad's handwriting, which I really love, and my grandma's, and like all the way up till when we came from Germany to America. So it's really old and like has a bunch of pretty handwriting in it.
I have a recipe book that's from my grandma. I think it means a lot because it's something that you have that she produced, and so I think it's neat, and it's something that you can kind of recreate.
We also want to hear about your handwritten treasures this hour. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. No way to send us a handwritten note this hour, but we would love to hear your stories. And with me in the studio now is Greg Prickman. He is head of special collections and university archives at the University of Iowa, where he is responsible for many handwritten treasures. Hello, Greg.
Hi.
Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
And in your archives, you do have a lot of records, a lot of journals, a lot of books that are handwritten, right?
That's exactly right. Lots and lots of correspondence, letters back and forth between people, family records, business records, ledgers where all the accounts were written by hand. A book that was a record book that was kept on the first bridge over the Mississippi River from the people on either side of the towers counting the people who are going back and forth and noting when the ice is breaking up in the spring on the river, all that's written by hand. But even when you get into printed books, one of the things that's most fascinating to people today are those occasions where someone has written in the book. And so the presence of handwriting, even in printed books, is often quite fascinating, too.
Now, when you go back into these books, I mean, you can find amazing nuggets of history, but it's extremely cumbersome to try to dig into this kind of record. I know that you've been working hard on digitizing these
That's
records.
Right. That's absolutely right. The way traditionally that you would access this material is to sit in our reading room and go through a folder of letters and read them one by one. As you do that, you start to become very familiar with the handwriting that you see. And if there are a variety of individuals in that collection, you get to know who's who based on their handwriting, which is often very interesting. But yes, we've been trying to digitize manuscript material. And then we have a project we call DIY History, where we put those images up online and we ask people to transcribe them, which means looking at that image of a letter or a diary page and typing in the text that they are reading. That way, then, we can make that text searchable by a computer. But we're actually inviting people to read the handwriting and to interpret the handwriting for us.
So what is it about the experience, do you think, going to the source? I mean, once all of these things are transcribed, we'll be able to have a searchable history of what's in these Civil War diaries or these culinary manuscripts, and that will be an extraordinary thing. But what is special about going to the source for you?
You know, for me, the presence of the handwriting in the script, handwriting is expressive. It is always expressive. And so by going to the source, by seeing how somebody wrote, not just what they wrote, you really can get a sense of more than just the words that they put down on the page. So yes, we can search that text, and that's a powerful tool for research. That's great. But when you actually view the original documents, whether it's in person or it's online with an image of the writing, you can get, oftentimes, you can get some sense of who this person was and perhaps other context, other hints at what might be going on. Handwriting isn't static. It changes over time for an individual. And you mentioned cookbooks, and some of the listeners who were interviewed on the street mentioned, I think two people mentioned, cookbooks or recipe cards. And, you know, we'll have these cookbooks that have been passed down through generations. And so, yes, you could search for a recipe and find where that occurs. But when you're looking at the object, you see, oh, this is one person's handwriting, and now the date, we're going forward in time, and the handwriting changes. And it's likely that that was passed on to another family member. You can't get that just from searching the text.
Right. And even if it's just marginalia on a printed book, you can
right.
get your grandmother's comment about why this recipe doesn't work that well.
Oh, exactly. I mean, the Jackie Robinson article, a newspaper clipping about Jackie Robinson, is interesting. But if it's signed by him, if there's any writing on it, well, that's a whole other story. I mean, that just brings you instantly into some connection with that person, given the expressive nature of the handwriting.
Now, in a few minutes, we're going to talk a little bit about how teaching handwriting has changed. Of course, penmanship, for the most part, is a thing of the past. And a lot of young people, they're exposed to cursive. Most people get exposed, I think, at some point, although less and less often. But a lot of people never learn to really write in it. They never become fluent in cursive. When you have students reaching you at the university level, do you find that your students write in cursive?
Some do. Many don't, based on what I've seen. We do have students using DIY history in the classroom. We have some faculty in rhetoric who have devised curriculum modules that use DIY history. And what they do is they ask the students to choose a letter. And then once they've sort of settled on what they're going to work on, it's just one letter in the collection, they will transcribe it. That's the first job. And so they have to become very familiar with the writing on that page. Then they go and research, who was this person? What were they doing? Who are they writing to? All of those, that sort of research. And what we have, it's been a couple of semesters, it's been two semesters of this now that they've been doing this. And it's been a great experience for the students, and they've all been asked to write reactions to this assignment. And when you read through these reactions, sometimes you'll see a comment about handwriting or cursive. Sometimes a student will say, well, I looked through a bunch to find one that was legible. But that could be true even if you are fluent in cursive.
Right.
Some are easier to read than others.
What I'm getting at is I'm wondering if students who don't know how to write in cursive or don't do it regularly have a hard time reading it.
I haven't really noticed that to be a barrier. And in reading through the students' reactions to an assignment like this, that doesn't seem to be too much of a barrier. I mean, they struggle through some of it, but they're doing it together in a class. And so if they're struggling with a word, others will look at it. And again, the more time you spend with it, the more the letters and the words emerge from the page. But the handwriting is only one aspect of a document like that. There's the language that's used, the idioms and the references that don't make any sense to us now without doing further research. And if anything, I think what we've heard is that the students struggle a little bit more with that than they do with actually interpreting the letters, the writing.
It's interesting to me when I think about my own handwriting, which is not very good. But when I write something for someone else, I make an effort to make it legible. When mm-hmm. I write something for myself, I know that I can read it.
Right.
So when you're looking at these old manuscripts, do you get a sense of whether somebody was writing in the idea that someone else would read their work or whether they were just writing for themselves?
Absolutely. I mean, there's absolutely no doubt that the writing changes depending on what they're doing. One of my favorites is we have a collection of Civil War letters from a quartermaster. So he's an officer. He's not necessarily on the front lines in a hole in the ground writing a letter. His letters, he's educated. His letters, the handwriting is actually very nice, very even, very legible. Then we have a brief letter that he's writing to his young son, and the handwriting changes. The tone of the letter, of the message changes. He puts a little circle on the page and says, I'm kissing the circle, and if you kiss it, then you're getting a kiss from your dad. And the handwriting expresses that. It's completely different than some of the other letters that he's writing, which are much more formal.
Well, we're going to have a lot more time to talk this hour, but so few of us are leaving behind treasures like that now. I'm very curious to get your response to what you feel about the historical record that we're creating at the moment. But we do need to take a short break right now. With me is Greg Prickman. He is head of special collections and university archives at the University of Iowa. We've been talking about the handwritten treasures that he has in his collection. We also want to talk about the handwritten treasures that you have in your collection. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9000. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We're also going to focus on the evolution of handwriting, how it's taught and how it's used today as well. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about handwriting, and we've been talking about handwritten treasures that we have in our collections, our historical collections, and our personal collections. And we're also going to talk about the evolution of handwriting. Penmanship is mostly a thing of the past, but even just learning to write in cursive is becoming more rare. Producers Lindsay Moon and Claire Roth asked people about their handwriting and their experiences of learning to write in cursive.
I guess I was in third grade, so that puts me at what, like 6 years old, 7 years old? It's like unlegible to write in cursive for, like, at least my cursive is, so yeah, I just kind of dropped it after a while.
I do, because I wanted to learn, so I learned as an adult. But this is different because I grew up in Mexico, and by my time, they didn't teach us cursive in our schools.
We didn't have, we didn't call anything cursive writing or anything like that. It was just this Palmer method of handwriting. That's all I knew, and yeah. Everybody yet that sees my handwriting, my grandchildren, and they all think I write beautifully.
Other than my signature, no. I wasn't a very good student of that. Just had a hard time grasping it.
We're talking about handwriting this hour. With me, Greg Prickman. He is head of special collections and university archives at the University of Iowa. And joining us now is Donald Baer. He's a professor of literacy studies at Iowa State University. Hello, Donald.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
And from your perspective, I know that anecdotal evidence shows us that fewer and fewer people are learning to write in cursive, or they're introduced to it, but they never get proficient at it. Do you see this disappearing?
Yes, I do. We don't spend enough time teaching handwriting. We, particularly obviously in the primary grades, for manuscript in the first grade and getting into cursive by third. I work with children who struggle to learn to read. So what's the role of handwriting with those children? And there's some evidence that that extra practice in handwriting does benefit one's learning to read, actually.
Really? In what way?
The writing gives, well, in Iowa, there are many people who think that a multi-sensory approach to learning to read is helpful. So when you're making the letters, you're making motor pathways that cement the knowledge into your brain, so to speak. There are patterns in words. Think about how quickly you write your own name, or think about how quickly you write the word A-N-D. You've got those down. But if you look at a first grader, they copy letter by letter. But as they get a sense of the phonics, they move to patterns, and then they start copying in more fluid movements. So the word cave, at first they might copy it letter by letter, but then as they learn about long vowels, they write more fluently. We can learn about your word knowledge by looking at how you write words to some extent.
So is there a connection between, in saying that it helps with their literacy and learning to read, if they write a word, does that help it stick in their brain better than being exposed to it visually several times?
That's a good question. That's more of an academic question. Some children need that extra practice, and so writing the words does help a lot. And yes, it's all of a kind. That is, learning to write and learning to read are part of the same processes. Matter of fact, I know it's a different subject, but children learning to spell, actually, that's serving their reading more than it is their writing. So it's an integrated a way of teaching that we want to look at reading and writing, and handwriting is a part of it.
Now, of course, we are spending a lot more time teaching kids keyboarding skills, which are incredibly important in this day and age. We all need to have them. So when we're working on a computer, if you're typing words, are the connections the same as they would be if you were writing them by hand?
That's a great question, and that's the academic question. There's evidence to say no, that let's say the studies that have been coming out recently have children, very young children, but we can talk about older. They copy a letter, they trace a letter, or they keyboard a letter or a word, and the strength is in writing the letter yourself, not tracing, not typing. So the motor pathways seem to be, if you will, more amenable to learning when you're using your whole hand. But I think we also have to look at frequency and practice, and that's one of the problems with the studies, is that maybe if the children had had more practice in keyboarding, that may have changed. And indeed, when I type a word, T-I-O-N, that comes as a fluent, or a suffix, that comes as a fluent movement when I type T-I-O-N, and that's not the case developmentally, let's say, for a second grader. So we are studying how people learn fluency in their typing as well. It is a different process right now. When older students take notes, they do a better job and when they do it by hand than what a study showed than when they do it on the keyboard. And there's some reasons for that. Again, partly related to the technology, we just haven't gotten there yet, and partly related to experience in keyboarding.
Well, that's very interesting. When you say older students, are you talking about college students? How much older?
High school and college.
Okay, so at the point where a lot of people are taking their tablet to class or even a laptop to class, and writing their notes on that. They may be processing that information in a different way by transcribing it to a computer as opposed to taking notes by hand?
Yes, when you said transcribing, yes, because often what they find is that it's very literal what they're writing down. So when I take notes in class on a keyboard, I try to take verbatim sometimes, at least that's what the students tended to do. Hmm. When you're writing by hand, you tend to chunk it a little better, and you're doing more processing. I think that's the issue, and that's the key to all good study techniques, is repeated practice. So what I would ask that student who was keyboarding is to take those keyboarding notes, those notes that they typed, and then boil them down on another, you know, on as they keyboard, into an outline. We did the same thing in handwriting, certainly. Sometimes we were too verbatim in our note-taking, and we needed to condense them. And I would point out that the core standards are sort of addressing that a little bit nationally when we look at the big term is annotation. We're teaching students how to annotate, whether it's by hand, reading with a pencil. We want students to always be reading with a pencil and not the long marks with the magic marker, if you will. And we need to have better technology to do so with our iPads. We are going to e-books. The publishers are not looking back. The testing that the children are going to be taking online is involving keyboarding more so than writing. So that's an issue to attend to. But when we look with little children, the handwriting is helpful. And we also need in Babyland is to show the children how to hold the pencil. I have students, older students, who have calluses on their thumbs or different because they aren't even holding the pencil correctly. And part of writing is fluency, getting your ideas down quickly and easily.
Interesting. Well, we're going to dig into some of those ways of teaching handwriting and some of the older ways of teaching handwriting as well in just a moment. But I do want to bring a few other people into the conversation this hour. We're talking about handwriting. We're talking about the evolution of handwriting, but also about our handwritten treasures. And we have a lot of people who want to share their stories on the line at 866-780-9100. Ruth is with us from Lidderdale. Hello, Ruth.
Hello, Charity.
Hi, what are your treasures?
My treasures are some letters that were written to my grandmother when she was a teenager in the late 1800s. And some other treasures are other letters to family members around the time of World War I. And these just recently came in, very helpful for a local college student who is doing a project on anti-German sentiment in Carroll County during World War I. And I happen to have a letter written by my great-grandmother in which she describes an incident about a local Carroll man being called pro-Hun, and that statement started an altercation. And I believe it was written up in the local newspaper also.
Wow.
And then I have about 1,000 letters, this is more recently, from World War II, written by both an uncle and my dad. That's before I was born. But those are treasures. And also I have a friend who moved away when she was 10 years old, and we have been writing to each other for about 55 years, and that is writing. We do not call, we do not email, we write letters.
Oh, wow. And I hope she's saving her letters, too.
I think she saved some. I have one from before she was married, and she's been married over 40 years, in which she describes kind of a night on the town, you know, as kids used to do then, cruising up and down the main drag and meeting a guy from another town. And it's really cute.
Oh, that's wonderful. Ruth, thank you so much for sharing.
You're welcome.
And you can join our conversation as well at 866-780-9100. And Greg, that brings me back to my question about, you know, Ruth is leaving a historical record for her kids and
That's
her
right.
grandkids. But a lot of us are not leaving a physical historical record. I mean, certainly I have a lot of emails that mm-hmm. I've written over the years and Facebook messages and text messages and all of that. But what are we leaving behind?
It's a great question. I mean, when I hear Ruth talking, I'm just sort of bouncing up and down in my seat. I'm so excited. I would love to see those materials because that's exactly the sort of thing that people that people want to look at and read that brings the history of those eras to life. For our era, it's going to be different. There's absolutely no doubt. And I think my profession has not entirely figured out how we're going to deal with this. You know, email is one thing, and that's not a simple thing, but people tend to stick with an email address. There's a bulk of messages built up, and there are ways to harvest that and address that. You know, we're looking at things with donors now about access to accounts, passwords, hard drives, and then what do we do when we have them? In the archival profession, it's very typical to want to keep things more or less in the shape and the condition and the arrangement that we find them in, because that tends to have some meaning about how those materials were created or used. Well, if you're dealing with files on a hard drive, how do you let people access those? Do you just let people in there to click around? Could documents be modified? I mean, even that date modified, right, the metadata in the file can be changed, and that is significant in terms of when that document was created or used. So there are various approaches that have been taken, emulating hard drives. So you're making a copy, keeping the original intact, essentially. All of this is going to be evolving at an increasing pace in years to come.
Well, and I think about how all of this digital connection has changed the way we communicate as well. I used to be a letter writer, and I have a couple filing cabinet drawers full of letters that I wrote in my teens and 20s to friends, a boyfriend, my brothers, or letters from them as well. And then suddenly when email took over, my communications got so much shorter.
Right. Right.
So it was it's just a very different way of communicating. And the idea of sitting down at a computer and writing what would add up to 7 or 8 pages of a letter,
right,
just
right,
almost never happens.
What will be interesting, I think, is to figure out if we have access to all those different types of messages, do we end up with a mosaic that still communicates a time and a place, what's happening, how people are feeling? You know, it may not be 7 pages, but if there's a sequence if there's a Twitter feed, you know, that is documenting someone's thoughts over time, what's that going to communicate? I don't think we have the perspective yet to know. I think it's, you know, in 100 years, looking back on this era, this very formative era of digital communication, how are people going to interpret those messages versus those handwritten messages from the previous era? You know, it's definitely going to be different. I don't know yet that is to say that it will be less significant.
Right. Let's go back to the phones. Trent is on the line in Kelowna. Hi, Trent.
Hi there, Charity.
And you have a treasure as well, right?
Yes, that's right. When my wife and I were married about 13 years ago, one of the rules we made for ourselves was that at Christmas time, one of the gifts we gave each other had to be homemade, or at least something that's not just purchased. And 1 year, I contacted about 80 of our relatives and friends a couple months before Christmas, gave them each several quarter sheets of typing paper, and told them that I was making a flip calendar for my wife, and would they each write down a memory or a message for her and sign their name. And when I collected them all, I came up with, you know, 365 of these for a full year of flip calendars. And it's wonderful every day to flip and see another handwritten message from someone. So not only do these significant events or memories or messages from these people, not only are they historically documented for her, but they're handwritten by these people in their penmanship with their name. And it's just turned into a wonderful personal account of different people and that we know.
Oh, that's wonderful. Trent, thank you so much for sharing.
You're very welcome.
And we have an email here that I think is very interesting, and it relates somewhat. There's a connection, trust me, to what Trent was just talking about. This is an email from Brian. He says, what about the long-term effect of using those knobby, imprecise pens and insensitive pads in electronic credit exchanges at grocery stores, etc.? Is this changing the form of people's signatures? Since 9 out of 10 times we sign our names, it doesn't come out the way it should. I get kind of lazy about it. Once while traveling abroad, a cashier made me re-sign because he said my electronic signature didn't match the real pen signature on the back of my credit card. And Donald, this doesn't have to do with penmanship. I mean, our signature, our handwritten signature, is supposed to be unique. Yeah. And it's supposed to say something about us. And clearly with Trent's family record, those signatures mean a lot. What about our signatures today?
I don't think they mean much. I think they'll catch us if they want. Maybe in Europe they were more sensitive. but I think we want to have children be interested in writing, making their own pens, looking at the felt tip, but using the felt tip calligraphy pens. It's exciting to write by hand, and we can really have a good time. And on the way, look at the history of handwriting and literacy, for that matter.
Well,
so there are a lot of fun ways of doing it as well. And I would ask teachers not to make it on the board, but rather show the children how to write the letters sort of flat so they can see your hand movement as opposed to the board.
Interesting. Well, and technology can help us out with that as well. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about handwriting this hour, handwritten treasures and the evolution of handwriting. And you are welcome to join the conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Donald Baer, professor of literacy studies at Iowa State University, and Greg Prickman, who is head of special collections and university archives at the University of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about handwriting. We're talking about handwritten treasures from the past and also how handwriting is evolving. With me is Greg Prickman. He is head of special collections and university archives at the University of Iowa. Donald Baer is on the line. He is professor of literacy studies at Iowa State University. And just before the break, we were talking about signatures. And I know you didn't get a chance to weigh in, Greg, on signatures. And we were talking about what they may mean or not mean today. But in the past, they were extremely important, and you found evidence that people took a great deal of care in coming up with a signature.
Oh, that's definitely the case. And we have books that people have written in from an era when paper was not as abundant necessarily. And we'll find on the end papers of the book, the blank sheets, that people will be practicing their penmanship, and what they're using to practice with is their name, and they'll sign it over and over again, and it will sort of change, and you can see them playing with it. And I think that's an aspect of this notion of teaching handwriting versus keyboarding, is that notion of play and experimentation and creativity. You can see how people will sort of be forming the letters differently as they're doing different versions. When you keyboard, you hit the key and it looks exactly the same every time, unless you know how to experiment with changing the format and whatnot. But I think there, when you're experimenting with script, there's a lot more room to play around with letters.
That is interesting. Although back when penmanship was a primary focus in schools, creativity wasn't a big part of it often. Uniformity.
That's very true.
Was a very big part of it.
And you have to, you know, think about an era when handwriting was how everything was communicated. You had to learn certain types of script based on the type of work you were going to do.
Well, let's go back and learn a little bit about the Palmer method, which we heard one of the people in our collection of voices earlier talking about learning to write by the Palmer method. And this is a very specific type of handwriting, the penmanship that was taught, that was developed right here in Iowa. And here's an excerpt from a documentary that was produced by Rachel Jeffries when she was a producer at WOI Radio in Ames.
Practicing handwriting by forming letters from the Roman alphabet. What's so special about that? Well, it's a big contrast to what the vast majority, 80%, of schools all over this country were teaching for much of this century. The painstaking repetitive formation of strokes long before letters. Careful ovals and exactly slanted angles done with strong muscular movement of the whole arm. This was the Palmer method, developed by the most famous, or infamous, Iowan in the field of handwriting, Austin Norman Palmer of Cedar Rapids.
Round and round and round we go, touch the line above, below. If on the nails you will glide, you can give your pen a ride. If under the wrist we see the light, you can skim just like a kite.
Hundreds of millions of people know the name of A.N. Palmer and remember all those exercises his method forced them to do. Admittedly, the Palmer method did produce a beautiful round hand. If only you could get through the exercises.
Round the ovals, round some more. Keep your feet flat on the floor. Round and round and round we go. 400 ovals in a row.
That does not make me nostalgic for doing penmanship exercises. And Donald, the Palmer method spread around the nation, and it was very popular for a long time. But it pretty much stopped being used in the 1970s, right?
Yes, 1950s, 1840s to 1950s. And they also shifted lefties to righties, as I recall.
Well, I don't know about that, but that sounds like a really frustrating thing to have done to a child. What are the methods that we use now? Do we have penmanship methods similar? I mean, like the Palmer method, obviously not 400 ovals in a row. At least I hope not.
We do. And part of it is looking for efficiency and speed and legibility. And so but again, we're not emphasizing handwriting the way we might have 20 years ago. But we use Zahner Blaser has a method, and the Dunalian is another that you'll see in programs. Everyone is starting, pretty near everybody's starting with the manuscript, and some are showing you how slightly different letter formations. So how do you make a D? Some people start at the top, or some people start at the circle. So there are some differences in letter formation that are designed to move you more rapidly into cursive writing.
Interesting. And when you look, Greg, when you look back at old documents, do you find a certain uniformity in writing, or was it pretty individual?
Well, it's definitely individual. But yes, depending on the type of document, the writing will differ. And I mean, certainly record keeping was a very specific kind of writing. And of course, it would have to be legible. You don't want to mistake numbers for other numbers in your ledger book. But you know, we were talking about a short, quick communication. And in the past, that was the telegram. And we have many, many, many telegrams in the collection. And oftentimes those would be written down by somebody. They would receive the message at the telegram office and they would write it down and sign the name of the person who had sent it. And so we'll have these telegrams. And sometimes people will mistake that. They'll read it and see the signature and mistake that as the individual who's communicating the message, that's their handwriting, which is not the case. It's the person in the office. And those tend to be written much more quickly. You can just imagine the volume coming through with that kind of communication. But that was a very common way of communicating back and forth, again, by hand, but quickly and briefly.
Well, we have this email. This is from Stephanie from, let's see if, oh no, this is from Thomas in Fairfield. He says, one of my students worked as a server some time ago at private parties in New York City. Jacqueline Kennedy attended one of the parties, and my student ended up talking to her for a few minutes. Several days later, she received a written note card from Jacqueline Kennedy, who often wrote personal messages. It was thoughtful of Jacqueline Kennedy, and it meant a lot to my student. Although, when someone's in a position like that, you do wonder if she wrote all of those notes.
Absolutely. I mean, and it kind of comes back to the notion of a signature. The personal nature of how you form your letters really makes a difference. And there may be times when a note is not written by the individual, but somebody that's on their staff can emulate it,
right?
and emulate it pretty closely. One of the most famous cases in our collection is a book that is purported to have an Abraham Lincoln signature in it, and it's a forgery. And when you compare the signature in this book to verified, signed, official documents that Lincoln signed, it's clearly not the same. But people have built up arguments around this book and what it means in Lincoln's life based on a forged signature.
Interesting. That's very interesting. Well, We were talking just a few minutes ago about the Palmer method, and Donald, you mentioned left-handed students being forced to be right-handed. Mike in Ames, his dad had that experience. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Actually, I have a real quick comment about that and then a question for the archivist. It wasn't me. I grew up in the 60s. I was born in 1948. But my dad was born in 1915, and he was left-handed. I was not. I am not. He described the horrible experiences he had, and he was forced to write. I learned to write right-handed, always wrote right-handed. As a consequence, his handwriting was totally illegible. The question I have, he would probably think that moving to keyboarding was a real advance for left-handers. The question I have is for the archivist. Do you think we're doing an adequate job of really paying attention to whether digital records are really permanent as opposed to files that are in formats that become unreadable or media like CDs that eventually wear out?
It's an excellent question. I'm afraid there isn't a real easy answer to it. We are certainly very well aware of the perils of digital media and digital files and what can happen to them over time. So our goal increasingly is to try to get them into a stable format off of a physical media like a disk or a CD and onto some kind of network storage system so that we can begin to prepare to reformat them over time as document formats change and file formats change. We're going to have to be very aware of how compatible and convertible these things are. It's a huge question for us and one that is getting a lot of research and a lot of attention right now. I don't think we have all the answers yet, but we're definitely working on it.
Peg is on the line next in Des Moines. Hi, Peg.
Hello.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I have a volume of poetry from the early 1900s, I would believe. My great-grandmother and all her sisters, she had a lot of them, they were housekeepers at a seminary. They all married ministers. And this particular minister was in the seminary, and he wrote her poetry, and it's all on wildflowers. I mean, you know, there's rosemary and whatever. She did not marry this man, but I have the poetry, and what concerns me is it's written beautifully in script. It's all put together. I have it in a safety deposit box, but it's fading. How do you keep something like this?
The best way to keep something like that is simply to try to provide it with a relatively stable environment. Light is going to be the thing that will fade it the quickest. So keeping it in the dark is the best idea. Certainly you want to avoid a lot of fluctuations in temperature and humidity. You know, depending on the type of materials, the paper and the ink, it can sometimes be very difficult to reverse that sort of thing. That's the sort of thing we have a conservation lab at the library, and we would take a look at that and try to determine exactly what the composition of those materials are, because the treatment then would sort of depend on what it's made out of.
So is there a place that someone can take their things to get that kind of information?
Well, sure. I mean, at the library, we're happy to work with people. If they have materials and they have questions about how to care for them or if treatments are needed, we can certainly take a look at them, and we'd be happy to advise people on that.
All right. So, and Peg is in Des Moines, so should she look for a local archive that might do something similar?
Sure. State Historical Society is in Des Moines. There certainly are resources there. And some of this we can do based on photographs. I'd certainly be happy to take a look at anything that people might have.
All right. And we have so many people who want to get in on this conversation. Jill is on the line next in Des Moines. Hi, Jill.
Hi there.
Hi. What do you want to talk about?
I wanted to mention a historical connection to Father Kadich from St. Ambrose College in Davenport, Iowa. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Sorry, it's on speakerphone and I can't get it off. But anyway, he went to Rome and studied how the Roman letters were made that we consider our capital letters now. And he learned that even though now we only see the chiseled inscription on Roman monuments, those were made by hand first with a brush. And that informed all of the evolution of Roman capitals, which we use to this day, as well as italic upper and lower case. And then I wondered if mentioning upper and lower case might be something, as a calligraphy teacher, that the your expert there would want to talk about the upper and lower case storage of the printing blocks and what that did to letter forms.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we could talk all day about this.
We've got 3 minutes left.
Right. But what we refer to as upper and lower case actually refers to the layout of the type cases in a print shop. When books were printed by letterpress, individual letters on pieces of metal type were sorted into containers. So uppercase and lowercase separated the capitals and the small letters out. For sorting the type. So we've carried some of that over into our vocabulary, but the caller is absolutely right. The work on inscriptions and capitals, when we're talking about the forms of letters, we're talking about a legacy and a history that goes back thousands of years, and it's all tied together.
Fascinating. And we have a note from Stephanie in Cedar Rapids, and we are short on time. She described a beautiful keepsake that she was left by her mother that she has framed on the wall. But her point is really interesting. She says our disassociation with the handwritten word could potentially be a good thing, as a handwritten note, which was once as pedestrian as one could get, has become a special and unique thing to be shared between the people who are most important to each other. And that's very interesting. I wonder if handwritten messages have become more important because they are rare.
Well, again, it's the medium that's being used to communicate. And absolutely, in this day and age, getting a letter in the mail means something. It signifies something in a way that it used to be very ordinary, or a card, a signed card with writing on it. So I think, you know, again, in terms of talking about collections, when we have collections in the future that have a lot of electronic communication, the presence of handwriting, notes and letters and cards, I do think that will mean something.
And what do you think, Donald, from the perspective of parents? I mean, we can talk about school curriculum, but as a parent, when you see your child learning to write, you're helping them form their letters, what do you think we should pay attention to make sure that our kids can communicate this way?
The ideas that they're trying to express, that's what you want to concentrate on. So you want their ideas to feed the pen and not let the pen interfere with the ideas. One thing we haven't talked about is the interference of I'm worried about spelling the word correctly. And so we want to encourage the parents to, okay, what do you want to write? And then have the child put down all the sounds and letters they hear as they write those, as they write. And take pleasure in the alphabet and enjoy writing letters and enjoy using different media to make different messages and typing and integrating as many different forms of literacy as possible. Time in the saddle, whether it's by hand or by keyboard, are so important.
And before we end this hour, Greg, what do you think? Do you think that handwriting will become a thing of the past, writing in cursive?
I don't think so. At least, you know, there are degrees to everything, and I think we will see less of it. But we're still going to write. I really believe that's true.
Greg Prickman is head of special collections and university archives at the University of Iowa. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
And Donald Baer is professor of literacy studies at Iowa State University. Donald, thank you so much.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, Claire Roth, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. You can get in touch with us anytime. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Podcasting and on-demand audio of the show are available at iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow we're going to talk about Templeton Rye. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.